Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 30th of April. The world food crisis is what we talk about this hour of the program. High prices, some of which have more than doubled in 2 years, and it's resulted in riots in many countries, and many of the protests have turned quite violent. Rioters tore through three cities in the Western African nation of Burkina Faso last month, burning government buildings and looting stores in Cameroon. A taxi driver's strike over fuel prices turned into a massive protest about food prices, leaving over 20 people dead. Protests took place in Senegal and Mauritania. Late last year, Indian protesters have burned hundreds of food rationing stores in West Bengal in October. This week in Bern, Switzerland, UN leaders have been meeting to try to find a way out of the current food crisis. The UN General Secretary Ban Ki-moon called the price climb unprecedented, a challenge of global proportions, and says that the first and immediate priority that we all agree is that we must feed the hungry. There's been a huge shortfall in funding for the World Food Program. New measures have to go beyond emergency relief, and the UN has developed a $1.7 billion plan to provide seeds of the world's poorest countries. Obviously, there are some huge questions here. Some of the high food prices have happened just over the last couple years, and really even over the last couple months. Wheat, corn, rice, and other basic foodstuffs have tripled, or with much of the increase taking place in just the last few months. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 227-2050. And you can send us an email as well. The email address is talk@WPR.org. We have two guests with us the first half hour, and we'll have two with us the second. For the full hour, Dan Gustafson is with us, director of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. He's worked for the past 30 years on agricultural and rural development in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, as well as in the United States. He did some studying here in Wisconsin. He holds a master's in science in agricultural economics from the University of Wisconsin and a PhD in agricultural extension from the University of Maryland. Beginning his career in Brazil with the Inter-American Institute for Cooperation on Agriculture, has worked at the University of Maryland as program director of the university's International Development Management Program, and joined the Food and Agriculture Organization in 1994, first in Mozambique. And we thank him very much for being with us. Dan, thanks so much for being with us to talk about this very important issue.
My pleasure.
Also joining us this half hour, we have another guest. So we have a lot of experts. Dr. Ken Moore is a professor of agronomy at Iowa State University, where he's been a faculty member since 1993. He studied at Arizona State University, has degrees in agronomy from Purdue University. And his research interests include development of improved systems for the production and utilization of biomass and forage crops. He's director of the Master of Science in Agronomy Distance Education Program and Crop Advisor Institute at Iowa State University. Both these gentlemen have done much more than what I've outlined, but it would take a half hour to get into all they've done. Dr. Ken Moore, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. Good morning.
Yeah, let's just start with a basic question, and let me direct this one to you, Dan. Why is it that food prices have gone up so dramatically, tripled, doubled in the last couple of years, and we've seen a lot of the rise in just the last couple of months? What happened?
Well, I think you touched on some of the issues in your introductory remarks really quite well. There are these longer-term trends and underlying problems that we've been seeing for quite a few years, and then more recently, a number of policy moves that have exacerbated and really exaggerated the issues. But over, let's say, a somewhat longer period, certainly one of the factors has been rising demand, both globally in terms of consumption. We see now developing countries, particularly India and China, often referred to in shifting into more consumption of meat and dairy products, so that raises the demand for grains. Coupled with that, of course, is very new and very large demand for corn and the U.S. bioethanol program. There's also been a decline for quite a long time in agriculture prices that turned around long-term trend somewhere around 2000 or so. But it had been a sector that in many countries seemed to be in decline. Investments in agriculture were down. International investment from donors and World Bank and so on was also down. And then we got to a point where global food stocks have been on the decline also since about 1995 and really are now at really quite a low level, the lowest that they've been in a long time. And then when you couple that with bad harvests in Australia and Western Europe in 2005 and 2006, and then stocks were lower yet, and then you get now the rise in oil prices that has a direct impact on production costs and transport and other things, and then the markets really start to tighten, and that's kind of what we were seeing last year. And then this year, in response to that, a number of countries took measures to limit exports, particularly of rice, which is already kind of a tight market and not that much rice is traded globally. And then with exports restricted, then everybody tried to purchase at the same time, and then the prices really just skyrocketed. So it really is a combination of factors over somewhat longer period and then policy moves that have just really exacerbated that situation.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the political upheaval that we've been seeing. Have there been even more riots than I mentioned in the beginning of the show?
Well, I'm sure there have been. I think that the important point that is often missed, though, and I think this is really the critical issue, is that even before this current crisis, there really was a big crisis for a long time, and that you had about 850 million chronically hungry people throughout the world. And these, of course, are the poorest and the most vulnerable for a lot of reasons. And that situation really was dramatic all the way through, and it's not like the world was doing spectacularly well in feeding the entire population. There was this underlying problem for a long time, and now what we see is a threat, and actually more than a threat, a lot of people moving now below the poverty line and into that category, this number of about 100 million people from the estimate from the World Bank on what these prices might mean for that. So it's, I think, this threat to the gains that have been made in economic development and people rising out of poverty that has really set off the political instability on top of an already really quite bad situation for hundreds of millions of people.
Let's go to Iowa for a minute, Ken, because from what I have read, the subsidized conversion of crops into fuel supposed to create energy independence, but it really has had a terrible effect on food policy as well, that we don't producing a gallon of ethanol from corn uses a lot of energy, and we could be growing other things here. So it is contributing to a world food crisis as well. Is that fair?
Kathleen, I think biofuels is having an impact on the price of grains and particularly corn. However, the estimates vary from 4 to 60% on how much of the increase in world food grains it can be attributed to ethanol. I guess it is, but I don't think it's the whole cause. I think, as Dan alluded to, the cost of energy, the cost for producing crops, the inputs for producing those crops and processing them and transporting them to markets is all contributing to the rise in food costs. So I don't think we can attribute it entirely to biofuels, and in particular corn prices, because corn is a feed grain. It's fed primarily to livestock, so any impact it would have on the price of rice, for example, would be indirect.
What about global warming? A lot of the press on this mentions again and again bad weather, which, if this all holds true, it could only get worse in a not too distant future, especially the Australian drought related to climate change has been problematic. Would you rank it way up there as one of the reasons for the crisis, Dan?
It's hard to say, I think, how high to rank it. Certainly, the Australian situation looks like it, extended drought, looks like it could be related certainly to climate change. And I think the interesting thing, though, similarly with the biofuels, is that in a really tight situation, any factor has, more sort of leverage on this than it would have otherwise. And the Australian situation, I think, is particularly interesting in that so much of the U.S. corn crop shifted into biofuel, and in other circumstances, that the area that was planted to corn that wasn't planted to wheat, for example, could have been taken up by some of the other larger exporters, but at that same time, then some of those, including Australia, had bad harvests. But I think it's important to point out, too, that actually agriculture production was up last year globally for cereals about 5%. And we would expect if the weather is good and we have reasonable harvest this year that it would be up again about 2.8%. So the really bad years for a drop in overall global cereal production were 2005 and 2006. But the last 2 years have actually been really quite good.
What about this, the United Nations World Food Program putting out a desperate appeal for more funds? These agencies, for what's the reason? They don't have enough money.
Right. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. In fact, I think it is often a little confusing in that point that even before the price rise, the World Food Program has, let's say, an estimate of how much emergency assistance would be required this year in places like Sudan, for example, and which would be somewhere around 4 million tons. And that estimate, I don't believe, has been increased, or hasn't been increased all that much. But the cost of not only securing those quantities, but also transportation and other things, has just upped the price tag dramatically. So really what they are looking for and don't have yet is money to do what had been previously programmed.
How much do you need?
Well, I think what they're asking for now is about $700
million. Hmm. And where would that come from?
Well, typically the U.S. has contributed about 40% of the total cereal part, but it would come from lots of different donors, mm-hmm. lots of different donor countries.
Mm-hmm. Ken, I know that you've done work on ecology on and you've done a lot of work on the design and analysis of agronomic experiments, crop management, ecology. Is a lot of that work being done in countries in the world that are having a hard time managing growing crops for whatever reason? Is that part of the answer here?
Part of the answer. Short-term solution, obviously, is to get food to the people who need it now.
Right.
But the long-term solution is to invest in agricultural research and particularly to develop in the human capital in those countries that are experiencing food shortages. One program, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, it's funded by Rockefeller and Gates, is doing exactly that, investing in developing improved technologies, improved crops in the places where they're most needed.
Let's welcome phone calls for both our guests. We're looking at the world food crisis this hour of the program. Our guests are Dan Gustafson from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Ken Moore is from Iowa State University. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And we also have an email, and that email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We talk about the world food crisis this hour, and our first caller is Fred from Columbus. Hi, Fred.
Hello. I just wanted to ask a simple question. Is this country still paying farmers not to plant crops? there was a set-aside program for numbers of years to just pay farmers not to plant crops. And I was just wondering if that's still set up that way, and if it is, it should be abandoned.
Ken, you want to take that?
This is Ken. I'll take it, sure. No, that program is no longer in effect and hasn't been for some time. We have a conservation reserve program that takes acres out of production that are environmentally in a position where they can influence water quality. But set-aside programs for managing surpluses are no longer done.
Let's go to Greg from Watertown. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Kathleen. I appreciate the program this morning. I really appreciate hearing talk about social capital as part of this answer to the questions we're asking. And I guess I have more than a comment than questions, and my comment would be this, that I don't think we're going to solve our food situation, our energy crisis, many of the crises that we see in our society until we start to think in terms of systems and systems thinking. And what's happening is with food and energy, we're running into physical systems constraints put in place by our environment. And whether we say this or that matters not. The environment's keeping track of the pollution, the degradation, the loss of resources, this peak phenomenon that's occurring with oil, water, soil. It occurs with social capital. And until we start to think in terms of systems conditions and or in systems thinking, we're not going to really make any headway, because one part will be played against another. If we look at the economy, that's going to leave shortchange the environment or the social structure. And we need to really take a holistic viewpoint. And my suggestion then is, I think the natural step offers a very good analyzation of the process for sustainability. It sets out systems conditions that are easily understood, definable, quantifiable for ecological sustainability. And then it sets out a fourth systems principle that defines social sustainability. And that's a lot less clear, but it's based on ethics and it's based on morality. And then there's also, with the system, the systems thinking perspective, there's a methodology to implement change, incorporating into it sound science and public input and dynamic process. And I guess that's the end of my comment, that we need to look at this differently than what we have been in the past, because the solutions that worked in the past aren't going to work anymore. We need right brain thinkers, and we need the whole system's perspective, a holistic viewpoint.
Yeah, you're very well informed. Thanks very much for the call. Dan?
Yes, it's a very interesting point. There was a large study that was released last week or the week before by an international panel organized by the UN called the International Assessment of Agriculture Science and Technology Development, kind of a long name and a long report, but basically says pretty much what Greg has been saying, particularly with regard to production by small farmers and the family sector rather than large, let's say, the plantation sector when you look at like Latin America and so on. But for most of the world's poor in rural areas, the problem has really been one of productivity and sustainable systems, and how the production and nutrition and economic growth and so on tie together through a more sustainable view of those production systems, as he outlined, is really the theme of that report.
And thanks very much for the call. An email, gentleman, Philip from Madison. What's amazing to me about our world food crisis is that, if I am not mistaken, the number of obese people has surpassed the number of people that suffer from chronic food shortage. Is this a function of agribusiness marketing their products to those who can afford to pay a premium, or the fault of consumers, or something else? Whoever wants to take it, start talking.
Okay. Well, let me say, this is Dan. Let me say that I don't know that I have an answer to that on either part of that question in terms of the numbers. It is certainly a very serious issue, even in countries that you don't think of. It's a very serious, obesity is a very serious and growing problem in India, for example, particularly with regard to children and diabetes and so on. And certainly the two things are often connected with people who are chronically hungry as children, then have a tendency often to, as they grow older and have more access to food and so on, to then go into problems of obesity. But I think that the underlying point is equally interesting, that certainly the overall, let's say, food and consumption system is not working properly to the extent that we have such large problems of obesity, and cutting out less nutritious aspects of our diet certainly could be part of the overall, has to be part of the global overall system.
Would you like to respond as well, please, Ken?
I don't think I can add anything further than what Dan has said. I would like to make the point that Dan actually alluded to earlier, that there are over 850 million malnourished people on this planet, and the population is continuing to grow, such that we'll be at 9 billion by the middle of this century. And in order to feed that population, we're going to have to double current food production from 5 billion tons to 10 billion tons by the year 2050.
Goodness.
So I'm thinking, you know, this current food crisis, which really isn't a shortage of food, but more about increasing cost of grain, it's a good wake-up call for us. It's going to focus our attention on these long-term underlying trends that Dan mentioned in his opening comment.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to put all of our resources into long-term solutions, increasing agricultural productivity, increasing infrastructure, human capital in those parts of the world that need it most.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about as countries get richer, countries like China and India, is their consumption of beef just skyrocketing here? And so it takes a whole lot more land to make the beef ready to eat. Is that the big problem, or is it something else?
Well, it's not only beef, but I mean chicken is probably a bigger factor, and pork. But actually, yeah, in the case of China, for example, per capita meat consumption went from 20 kilos, or let's say 44 pounds per person in 1980 to 50 kilos, or like 110 pounds per year in 2005. So it's just a huge increase in the amount of meat that a very large, obviously, Chinese population is consuming, with real high demands on livestock feed. And it's interesting in the Chinese case, because China has also done remarkably well in producing food and in increasing food production and lowering its overall poverty rate, or its poverty percentage of the population below the poverty line. Just a remarkable job. And in fact, China is an exporter in a number of important crops, but where the imports have really come is more in soybeans and oilseeds, and that is really attributable to the growth in demand for meat. The India case, of course, is somewhat different, and there the demand is largely for dairy products rather than for meat, but also with similar results.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Just before we move guests here, Ken, what's the most important thing we can do right now to address this crisis?
Well, I think the most important thing right now is to work with organizations such as the UN to get food where it's needed at a price that people can afford. The long-term answer is again, to invest in agricultural research and development in these places, and particularly in developing the human capital and the capacity for individuals in those countries to grow their own food and increase their own productivity.
Thank you so much for being with us. Ken Moore from Iowa State, Dan Gustafson from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, staying with us for the full hour. We're just introducing another guest. Per Pinstrup Anderson is a professor of food nutrition and public policy at the J. Thomas Clark Professor of Entrepreneurship and Professor of Applied Economics at Cornell University, and also of Agricultural Economics at Copenhagen University. He is a past chair of the Science Council of the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research, and served 10 years as the International Food Policy Research Institute's Director General, 7 years as department head, and he's been a distinguished professor at a number of universities, is the 2001 World Food Prize laureate, and is a recipient of several awards for his research and communication of research results. And he should be joining us right now. Professor Pinstrup Anderson, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah. And we have a lot of phone calls coming in on this, 800-486-8655, 227-2050, if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Let me just ask this question in a different way. Considering all the interrelated problems here with the food crisis, do you think that we have the right organizations, the United Nations meeting in Switzerland this week, to deal with this? Who all needs to step up to the plate, rich countries or who, Professor Pinstrup Anderson, to get a grip on this problem?
Well, first of all, the governments of developing countries need to take the action they should have taken a long time ago, namely to make sure that poor people get enough to eat.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a new problem. It's just getting worse. 5-6 years ago, when food prices were at the lowest level that we ever seen, we still had more than 800 million people who couldn't get enough to eat.
Mm.
Governments have basically been sitting on their hands, governments in developing countries, they've been sitting on their hands because they had very inexpensive food available to them, partly from import because of the agricultural subsidies in the United States and the European Union. There was lots of food available at very low prices, in fact, at prices below the cost of production. So therefore, governments didn't feel like investing in rural areas and in agricultural development. That was a huge mistake, which they have to rectify now.
Mm-hmm.
However, people are starving right now, so we need to help developing countries help themselves. And the best way of doing that is to provide the necessary money and food to the World Food Program, which is the international institution that's most capable of helping developing countries feed their poor people.
Mm-hmm. But Dan was telling us during the last half hour that they're short millions of dollars. They don't have the money.
That's absolutely correct. And it really is an ethical issue we have to deal with internationally. We can complain about the increasing food prices in the supermarkets in the United States and Europe, but quite frankly, whether we spend a little bit more, those of us who are not poor, whether we spend a little bit more on food or not, is not really going to affect our children's nutrition.
Yeah.
Now, we do have poor people in the United States as well, and they need help. And the food banks in the U.S. are running out of food as well. So it is an international problem. But the high-income countries, the governments of the United States and Europe, really do have to step up to the plate when it comes to making sure that the World Food Program has enough money and enough food.
Mm-hmm. Professor Gustafson, I've read that, and I'm wondering how much of what proportion of the world's people falls into this category, that there are so many people who have to pay 75% of their income on food.
Right. It's that is usually looking at the bottom 25% of populations in, the poorest countries of the world, and even some that aren't so poor, but sort of the bottom 25% of income class typically spends or can spend up to that 75 or 80% of their disposable income on food. And it's also generally the case that they spend it on food in its, basically raw form. So as Professor Pinstrup Anderson was saying, here in the U.S., we spend about something like 7% of our disposable income on food at the supermarket, and a lot of that, of course, is processed so that the actual, component of cereal in that is not very high. But for the people who are spending most of their income on food and in its raw form, you can just see what a devastating impact price rises really of any kind would have. And price rises like we've seen in the last year and since the beginning of this year really are just a dramatic effect.
Right. Let's go to Buck from Madison. Hi, Buck.
Hello, and I really compliment this constellation of good guests. We'd like to sit in armchairs with an hour by a fire to talk about all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to talk about the effect of raw human population on the planet and what this does, the ideal state in my own mind is that the world's population in the second Eisenhower administration, right? Whereas now we're up to about 6.5 billion, right? And it's going to grow. So would you guys talk about population?
I'd be delighted to start out the conversation about population. And the best way to help families have fewer children is to help them out of poverty. Once people leave poverty, they want fewer children. However, in order for that to happen, they also have to have access to family planning. They have to have access to reproductive health care. And this is one of the areas where the United States government could do a lot more than what it's doing in supporting reproductive health care assistance for poor people in developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we should sit back in the United States or Europe and say, look, we want to control the population in other countries. I think what we should do is to help families who would like to have fewer children to actually have the number of children they want and not more than what they want. And the best way of doing that, as I said, is to help them out of poverty and give them access to reproductive health care, family planning, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to add to that, Professor Gustafson?
Yeah, I would just add two things. I think one is that one of the best ways, most that has, let's say, the greatest impact in reducing family size is investment in girls' education.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
really is a tremendous thing for lots of reasons, but it looks like one of the most effective investments that countries can make in leading to smaller family size. The other thing with regard to the current, let's say, crisis and food prices and demand and so on, it looks really like the much more important factor is not the overall size of the population in the last couple of years, which of course has been increasing, but really the quite positive demand that comes from increasing income, so that the developing countries are now growing last couple of years at about 6% per year, which is very good by historic standards, and is really, as we were talking about earlier, leading to increased demand in changing diets and so on in India and China and elsewhere. But the income demand, the impact on demand from rising incomes is really the more important factor here.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else, Buck?
I am all in favor of Indians and Chinese becoming affluent, but all of us should be smaller in absolute size and less greedy.
Mm.
That's it.
All right.
Goodbye.
Thanks, Buck. Let's go next to Thor from Milwaukee. Hello, Thor.
I'd like to thank the professors for using their brains. I'm a former Army officer, and I weightlifted when I was younger, and I ate blue-green algae products. How about use of blue-green algae products to feed the third-world masses? As a disciple of war studies most of my adult career, it only takes 1 in 20 people, 5% of a population, to riot to overthrow fragile third-world governments. If you want to prevent war, the ancient Chinese strategists like Sun Tzu and the others say, feed the people, keep their bellies full. Otherwise, places like Egypt, if Egypt goes fanatic, Orthodox, fundamentalist Muslim, we got another big war in the Middle East and another oil energy crisis and all that stuff.
All right, Professor Gustafson.
Well, I think I don't have much to say, I think, on the blue-green algae, although as cattle feed, actually, there's some interesting work. I mean, certainly, I'm sure there's a way that we could get more of it into the human dimension too. I think on the social instability, I think this really is a critical point, and the situation is serious at the moment, largely because of this underlying long-term chronic hunger that is so much worse because of these high prices now. But the threat to social unrest and so on is, of course, real. I mean, people will react, as we've seen in that long list of countries that you mentioned earlier. So it is really a very serious situation.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Pinstrup Anderson, you want to respond?
Sure. I think we should consider alternative sources of food. Absolutely. I'm in total agreement with that. It's probably going to take a lot more research before we can develop blue-green algae for human consumption in a way that people would actually buy it. On the government legitimacy, on the food riots and so on, I think there's a very important point to be made, and that is 6-7 years ago when the food prices were extremely low, you still had a very large number of people who were too poor to buy or to get access to the food they needed to feed their children. But they were mostly in rural areas, and they were not a threat to governments, and therefore governments didn't do very much about it.
Hmm.
Now what we see is that the urban lower middle classes in countries like Haiti and Egypt and Pakistan and many other countries are taking to the streets and threatening the government. And the worst solution to this problem is that the governments around the world limit themselves to solving the problem for the urban lower middle class, leaving all these many millions of poor people in rural areas exactly the way they have always been, namely extremely poor and too poor to feed themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very important when I hear the debate about the world food crisis, I frequently hear, look, we now have 100 million additional people who are hungry, but nobody's talking about the 800 million that were hungry when food prices were low and the governments were doing virtually
right,
nothing.
Right, yeah, exactly. Email Mary from Nina. How much of the starvation in the world is due to crop shortages because of civil war? Professor Gustafson?
Well, I don't know that I have a figure exactly for that now, but it was the case some years ago when you would look at where World Food Program, WFP, was working, and in 80% of the 80% of their total food distribution were in areas that were affected by some kind of man-made crisis rather than simply because of drought. And at the numbers on that, of course, are quite high. I think at the moment where we see most food insecurity globally because of the rising prices would not be so much accounted for that. It would really be because of the rising prices, but you still have this this core of emergency situations, some of which is drought and a lot of which is unrest. And we'd see in Kenya, for example, recently, and in Sudan and the Darfur region and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I can just add to that, I agree with that. I think in the global food scarcity or food crisis, armed conflict probably are not a major part of the problem, but in specific countries and specific regions of countries, parts of Congo, for example, in the past, Mozambique and Angola were very much affected by armed conflict and by food production. So I think it depends on which country and which part of the country we're looking at, but in the big global picture, it probably isn't that that much of an issue.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the call. We pause for a moment and return. We're looking at the world food crisis this hour with two distinguished guests. Our number is 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. Professor Dan Gustafson is the director of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations Liaison Office for North America. He has worked for the past 30 years on agricultural and rural development in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, as well as in the United States. Professor Per Pinstrup Anderson is the H.E. Babcock Professor of Food, Nutrition, and Public Policy the J. Thomas Clark Professor of Entrepreneurship and Professor of Applied Economics at Cornell University, and he also teaches at Copenhagen University, past chair of the Science Council of the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research. To your calls, more of them, many of them, in just a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now, let's go to Tom from Black River Falls. Hi, Tom.
Hello. What I was calling about was the government give us this mess that we got with this ethanol right now, but the people have got a way to get out of it. 5 years ago, I quit using ethanol, and my mileage increased in my car from 20, on a Buick Sabre from 23 to 30. I've told 50 to 100 people since, and I've never found anybody that got less than 4 miles a gallon better with a car, up to 10 miles a gallon better by running regular gas without 10% ethanol. And that would solve the problem. We would cut our use of fossil fuels, cut pollution, and save the third world starving poor, because our government's never going to act fast enough. We've got to do it on our own.
All right. Anybody want to respond, just take it.
Yeah, I think the corn-based ethanol program with the heavy government subsidies in the United States was a big policy mistake, and I just wish the government or the administration could find a way of getting out of that. It is really not helping us on the ecological side. It is not reducing our CO2 footprint. The ethanol is less efficient, as pointed out by the caller, and it is having a negative effect on food prices. So I think that program was misplaced. It's the wrong time for that program, and we should rather be spending the money on research to develop a new feedstock for biofuel that doesn't compete with food production.
Mm-hmm. Do you see, though, is there so many people making money off this now? Do you see this kind of maybe change in policy happening, Professor Gustafson, in the United States?
I think it's hard to say. I would have thought, let's say, some months ago that there would have been really no chance of that. But I think it's particularly interesting that a lot of the impact on the rise in prices lately is really due to policy decisions in the case of restricting exports and other things, in addition, of course, to biofuel. So I think that there is a lot of pressure to examine solutions that governments can actually do something about, unlike the weather and broader demand changes and so on in developing countries. And certainly the biofuels program in the U.S. and Europe are under a lot of pressure. And I'm not certain, actually, what we'll see.
Tom, you had another question? Oh, no, it's another Tom. All right, this Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi, sorry. My question is on biofuels, but on the biodiesel part of it.
Okay.
So which is the different animal as far as the BTUs you get out of it for every BTU put into it? And as for myself as an individual, to run my cars in the most ethical way, I get it from the restaurants myself, and I get it like a 10-to-1 ratio versus a 3-to-1 ratio versus ethanol is a 1-to-1 ratio. My question is, how far do I push the biodiesel as a larger part of the national transportation policy? Where you experts stand on this right now? Because it's right now biodiesel is under pressure for what's going on down in the Amazon basin. It's actually tearing down part of the Amazon to put up soybean fields, which I absolutely am against. Where do you stand right now on what's going on in the United States with that? That's my basic question.
Well, maybe if I could just start
and
clarify a couple of things. I think that the criticism on biodiesel has come more from Southeast Asia and oil palm and the impact on the environment and destruction of rainforests in Southeast Asia. The Brazilian situation and the Amazon is different, and that really is related, or the criticism has been related, to the ethanol program from sugarcane, and not that sugarcane is moving into Amazon or Amazonian sort of fringe areas, but that it is all somehow, the criticism at least, is that it's all somewhat related, so that sugarcane displaces areas where soybeans were grown, and then soybeans are moving further north into destruction of rainforest and so on. But I think that the biodiesel part and even the Brazilian sugarcane-based ethanol programs are not under the same level of criticism and pressure as the U.S. bioethanol from corn is.
As environmentalists, do you still support what's the biodiesel movement in this country? That's a basic question for me.
Well, I don't know that I really know enough about it, I guess, to say one way or the other.
Right. Because I'm, as a local advocate, I'm trying to advocate this, but I want to make sure I'm advocating the right thing. I think I am. But people are lumping in the global scene in with the local scene, and it's really confusing. A lot of times we have to come in and do damage control. It came out of the Time magazine article that came out last week, and they just kind of lumped it all into one big glob. And mm-hmm.
Right.
Just
if I could just comment
thing.
On that, I think that's a very important point too. That that bioenergy, even on farm production, is an important aspect. That certainly we don't want to eliminate altogether with the criticism on the rise in prices now from the demand for corn because of and even the sugarcane situation and so on because of the current price rises. So I think that there is a real danger in going too far and eliminating all programs looking at bioenergy. In India, for example, there and other countries too, Africa and other places in Asia, looking, for example, for biodiesel from a plant called Jatropha, that mm-hmm. in some places has done much better than in others. But some places are having quite good successes with biodiesel from Jatropha, grown in areas that are not really good for much else. It also, of course, grows well in better soils and so on. So it's. There's always a danger that it would also displace food crops. But overall, I think there is, I agree really completely, there is a danger in throwing out the baby with the bathwater on the overall biofuels and bioenergy scene.
Tom, thanks very much. We need to move on to Ann from Madison. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Sorry, I have laryngitis. But I think there are two main factors in this the food crisis. One is globalization, which has been enforced very rigidly by so-called free trade agreements. And these were pushed on the world, on especially the poorer countries, by the world's richest multinational corporations, which are not meeting their side of the bargain. They're insisting on continued subsidies for their industries in the United States and the northern countries, while the poor countries aren't allowed to subsidize their own industries. So these global trade agreements have essentially driven local farming out of business all over the world. And in places like Haiti, which has rich soil and a great climate, it's denuded and people are eating mud cakes as a result. And the second factor is that with local agriculture almost dead and no legal restraints on the world's huge oil and gas companies, huge increases in oil and gas prices make the transportation of this multinational food system prohibitively expensive. And in countries that no longer have thriving local industry, which people relied on, these prices make food absolutely almost unobtainable. I just think that as long as the Bush administration, composed of oil mavens, is in power, nothing is going to be done about this problem, and they don't care whether people starve to death or not.
Thanks, Ann, for the call. Professor Pinstrup Anderson, want to take that?
Sure. I don't think it's globalization that's the problem. It's lack of globalization. It's a one-sided globalization, as the caller points out. We from Europe and the United States are asking developing countries to open up their markets for our highly subsidized food commodities. And that basically drives the local farmers out of business because we can make food available, or we could until these recent price increases. We could make food available in developing country markets at prices below the cost of production. So therefore, many of the 800 million poor people in rural areas were simply unable to compete. It is really not something that is brought about by multinationals or by globalization. This is something that the governments of the European Union countries, Japan and the United States, have designed for their own countries. So I agree with the caller to the extent that we should not enter into trade agreements with developing countries that involve these countries to open up their markets for highly subsidized agricultural commodities from the United States and Europe. That is grossly unfair. We should have true globalization where we actually do have free market on both sides and not just on one side.
Mm-hmm. Professor Gustafson?
No, I think that's quite right. And I think what we see now as part of the solution to this has to be a concerted effort among all countries around trade issues to allow freer trade from, in particular, low-cost, low-production-cost countries, which are generally developing countries, and access to their markets, in addition to reduction or elimination of export bans or quotas that we've seen now to free up world trade. So globalization is certainly part of the issue and how it has been managed, but globalization is actually also, in the sense of a concerted effort, is also part of the solution here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both so much. What an interesting and important hour this was. Thank you, gentlemen.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. Our thanks to Professor Dan Gustafson. He is the director of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations Liaison Office for North America, has worked for a number of years on agricultural and rural development in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, as well as in the United States. Professor Per Pinstrup Anderson is professor of food, nutrition, and public policy, and also a professor of entrepreneurship and a professor of applied economics at Cornell University and professor of agricultural economics at Copenhagen University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to Rhonda for on-air production here, answering all of your interesting phone calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 until 11, so tune in for our conversations tomorrow. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.